From RTE Radio, I'm Níl Óshiarthán. This is Playback Daily.
Leaned over and went, "Are you Dermot Whelan? I'm a big fan of your work." And I was like, "Great, can we just wait till we have clothes on to have this conversation?"
She's a unionist. She's a staunch supporter of Israel. And yeah, she is a conservative. Kneecap on none of those things.
I asked politely at this stage, "Would you please delete film of me with the dogs, because I like privacy and, to be honest, I don't like drones very much."
Coming up on this returning after Easter edition of Playback Daily, Dermot Whelan's naked fan problem, Kneecap's potential legal problem, and one woman's drone problem. That's all on the way over the next hour of the radio catch-up show that can be listened to clothed or not. No judgment here. And we're back after a body weight of Easter egg consumption to dive straight into the Oliver Callan monologue from this morning.
Now, there were absolutely loads of things happening over the weekend.
Wait, that's not... Is he doing a voice? Let me check my notes. It's Dermot Whelan, everybody. It's okay. He's supposed to be there. Let's continue and hear about a lot, and I mean a lot, of sport that happened over the weekend.
If you're a sports fan like myself, it was actually very hard to decide what you were going to watch and what you were going to watch and when. We might as well start with the GAA because that was the big one. Royal Flush stuns Dubs is the headline in the Irish Independence Monday sports section today after Meath beat Dublin in the Leinster Senior Football Championship semi-final, 23 points to 116. We've been hearing about it all morning on Morning Ireland, of course. And the question being asked in the paper this morning is it the greatest shock in Gaelic football history? It's difficult to think of a bigger one, really, or so says Eamon Sweeney in the Indo. I'm not sure if it was the greatest shock in footballing history, but it is true that Meath scored more in one half against Dublin than in the entirety of the previous nine meetings, lifting the hearts of the anyone but Dublin brigade around the country. Meath manager Robbie Brennan, who was obviously delighted after it, said he never doubted his side's ability to cause an upset. And he's quoted on the front of the Indo sports section saying, "All week, I just kept saying, we have to stay in the fight. If someone goes past you, you've got to stay in the fight. Stay in the game and keep hunting and looking for work." Great advice for life, really, isn't it? Not just sport. I can see maybe Robbie bringing out a self-help book one of these days. Cork tip 427 to 24 points in the Munster Senior Hurling Championship clash between Cork and Tip. The game was over before it started, many said, or at least it was for Tip corner forward Darren McCarthy, who was sent off for striking in the very first minute of the game. I was watching Henry Shefflin talking about it, and he felt it was a fair decision in fairness. And you know, I was watching that and the Waterford Clare game, another a bit of a one-sided affair as well. And it was just interesting to see. You just really felt sorry for the young lad, didn't you, for Dara? Because I think we can all relate to times in our lives when we came out a little bit too overzealous and messed things up a bit. And I wonder, was the hype in the dressing room just a little bit over-enthusiastic? But it definitely did, I guess, change the direction of the game. Another thing I noticed, why is it at GAA matches, even if it's freezing cold, there's always one young lad behind the goal but no top on? There's always one guy. I wonder, is there a decision made? I'll do it this week, lads. You know, I was looking at it and the parent in me was just worrying for his health. You know, it's freezing. He'll catch his death. Hopefully there was enough tin foil from the collective sandwiches in the crowd to make him one of those foil recovery blankets you see at the end of marathons or at accident scenes, and he didn't get pneumonia. I was on the GAA sidelines myself this weekend for the big one. I know. Bin Aider versus Clontarf under 14 girls. I know it's the one that you're all really thinking about today. My daughter was playing. And I want to know if any other parent notices this phenomenon that's happening on GAA pitches around the country. The gum shield scenario, because you can't play, they won't let the kids play unless they have a gum shield, and rightly so, because it protects their teeth and saves us all a fortune on orthodontics bills. But I don't know if you've noticed, but there doesn't seem to be one child with the gum shield actually in their mouth. They sort of have it hanging out like a sort of a weird rubber cigar. And they're all running around at full tilt, trying to play sports and breathe at the same time. And they can't be helping the breathing at all. And it certainly isn't doing the one thing that the gum shield is required to do, and that is protect their teeth. So I was wondering, does any other parent notice this? And is it just GAA? I'm sure maybe across all sports that requires gum shields, rugby maybe as well, where young kids just don't like having them in their mouth. So they all run around, as I said, with this sort of, like that thing you used to do when you had those milk teeth sweets as a kid and you'd have them sticking out of your gob. Football, of course, across the water. Liverpool secured a record equaling 20th league title in a party atmosphere with a 5-1 victory over Tottenham as fans at Anfield witnessed a championship triumph for the first time in 35 years. Lots of people, I know, very, very happy about that. And WhatsApp groups around the country were lighting up with the slagging. Certainly the WhatsApp groups on my phone. There was a lot of ribbing going on there. And other football news, Katie McCabe. What a hero. The captain of the Republic of Ireland's women's football team, Katie McCabe, is in her 10th season with Arsenal, has become the first Ireland international to reach the Champions League final since its inaugural year in 2009. Incredible achievement. Her club, Arsenal, of course, will take on holders Barcelona in the Women's Champions League final after a superb 4-1 victory at Lyon saw them triumph 5-3 over the 8-time winners on aggregate. I had the great fortune, actually, of visiting the Ireland women's football camp before they left for Australia for the World Cup last year. Was it last year or the year before? I'm losing track of my time now. I was in there for some mindfulness stuff and I was just so impressed by the entire squad. And of course, Katie McCabe is such a wonderful leader and a great example, and I think a great example to young girls as well who really want to get into sport and who are taken to pitches right across the country. So yeah, best of luck to Katie and Arsenal in the Champions League final. There was success as well for Monaghan in sport over the weekend when boxer Aaron McKenna secured an upset victory over former WBO light middleweight world champion Liam Smith by a unanimous decision. The fight at Tottenham Hotspur Stadium in London was on the undercard of the Conor Benn and Chris Eubank Jr. Showdown. The 25-year-old Monaghan man dropped Smith in the final round with a left hook to the body. And this is a clip from one of his post-fight dressing room interviews where he shows a lot of calm and a lot of ambition as well, actually.
Yeah, absolutely over the moon. That's what I've been talking about all these years. You know, the words I've been preaching throughout the years is finally come true now, and people are going to start taking notice. What an honour it was to share the ring with a legend of the sport, Liam Smith, a tremendous fighter, former world champion, and I'm just privileged to get the win over him. I said before the fight, I don't think he's seen half of what I can do, and I've seen a lot of boxing experts, you know, throughout the week not giving me a chance, saying Liam has too much experience for me and stuff like that. So I got to prove people like that wrong, and moving forward now, I want the world title next.
Yeah, sounds like maybe he had Robbie Brennan whispering in his ear. Very confident, very enthusiastic, very driven man. So well done to him. I was actually watching the boxing with my young fella. We were sat down and watched Conor Benn and Chris Eubank. And of course, the two sons of very famous boxing dads. And Chris Eubank was there. Never a man to take, a senior that is, to take a back seat. He was there in his flamboyant outfit. Very kind of strange looking sheepskin coat he had on him. But he was there walking around. And I think everybody kind of remembers Chris Eubank at the time of the Steve Collins fight. Steve Collins was cheating. It always stuck in my head. These little sporting moments that stay with you forever. But I was watching the boxing and then a famous man came up to the ring, came up to ringside and was given a little bit of advice or congratulations or something to boxers in the ring. And it was Gordon Ramsay, the chef. And I was like, what the hell is he doing there? Then you thought, actually, do you know what? It's probably quite fitting, because I'd say he'd be no stranger to aggression over the years is Gordon Ramsay. He's probably thrown an uppercut at a sous chef over the years. And maybe has the recipe for the perfect knuckle sandwich.
Is that enough sport for you? Didn't see that boxing coming. After all that physical activity, mind you, you're probably thinking you need a warm down strategy. So are a lot of people, apparently.
Saunas appear to be having a big moment in Irish culture, and you've probably noticed this phenomenon of them popping up all around the country. It is the saunification of Ireland, and it could see these modern sweat houses becoming, they say, the new Irish pub. According to outsider.ie, there are now 75 freestanding saunas dotted around the country, from Inchidonny to Portrane, Greystones and beyond. And by freestanding, I mean rejigged horse boxes, wagons and sheds on wheels. And it's not just saunas either. I've done the hot seaweed baths as well. And, you know, the ones in the old whiskey barrels too, down in the likes of Doolin in Clare. I'm a big fan of hot cold therapy. I've just getting into, although I don't think they call it like cold therapy. When we were kids, you just called it getting into the sea. You know, you weren't really aware of what it was doing for your stress response. It was just like going for a swim. But we've a lot of catching up to do with the Finns, apparently, who are huge sauna fans. According to the Irish Independent, the Finns have 3.3 million saunas for a population of 5.4 million people. So these saunas are being the special part of their home. I guess it's the Finnish equivalent of the good room that we have in Ireland, although they actually use it every day and not just when the parish priest calls around. I do know a pal who put a steam room into his house. I know there's a lot of saunas popping up in back gardens, and people with notions are including them in their new builds. But steam rooms, I guess, are a little bit trickier because you're just boiling a lot of water and it gets a bit moldy and all those kinds of things. But a pal of mine did put a steam room in his house when he was having some renovations done. A small thing. It's kind of like a cupboard, essentially, with steam in it. He said it's amazing. He's enjoying it. But he said his electricity bills are now causing more steam to be coming out of his ears. So it is worth bearing that in mind if you're thinking of installing what is essentially a giant kettle into your house. And you know our obsession with the immersion. So how would we be if we had optional steam rooms in there too? We could learn a lot from the Finns, though. They recently topped the world happiness rankings for the 8th year in a row. And sauna culture is said to be one of the 5 things making them happy. The other 5 being nature, food, sustainable design and lifestyle. So why does everyone love saunas? Well, aside from the social benefits, gathering and relaxing with people you know and don't know, although I do hate the old chit-chat in a sauna. We were having that conversation earlier. I like just get in there, shut up, don't be talking to me. Because I was in one of those nudie saunas in Austria recently, and a lady came in and sat down beside me. And by the way, you have to take your clothes off. This wasn't just one that I went looking for. It's not that I'm into it. You just have to do it. But a lady sat down beside me and then leaned over and went, "Are you Dermot Whelan? I'm a big fan of your work." And I was like, "Great, can we just wait till we have clothes on to have this conversation? It's a bit awkward." But they are said to be very good for your health. Cardiovascular health, muscle recovery, respiratory and cognitive health, mental well-being and immune function, all things that are meant to benefit from saunas.
3 minutes there of an education in saunas from Dermot Whelan, doing the monologuing on behalf of Oliver Callan this morning. Here's a question for you.
How happy are you at work?
Do you skip into the office every morning, or do you shuffle in resignedly with a grey cloud hovering above your head? This morning, Claire Byrne spoke to Mark Price, former Managing Director of Waitrose, former UK Trade Minister and author of Happy Economics, Why the Happiest Workplaces Are the Most Successful.
Happiness drives performance. So to put that into simpler terms, when I started with John Lewis as a graduate trainee in their department stores in the UK in 1982, it was that long ago, on the very first day, I was told by the then managing director that the supreme purpose of John Lewis department stores and Waitrose supermarkets was the happiness of the people that work there. And the guy that founded John Lewis and Waitrose nearly 100 years ago had this really simple idea. He reckoned, if my people are happy, they're going to stay longer. I'll have lower staff turnover. If they're happy, they'll be at work more. They won't be sick. And if they stay around more and they're at work more, then they can be trained. The training will stick. Customers will get better service. So I spent 34 years working with John Lewis and Waitrose, as you said, last 10 years running Waitrose, really trying to work out what is it that makes people happy at work. And wherever you're working, whether it's in the government or whatever you're doing, being happy at work is good for you. What we find is that people who are happy at work are more likely to be promoted, more likely to be paid more highly, have lower issues with their health and well-being, and are more successful.
But Mark,
and that, of course, is good for companies.
I would say, and I'd be interested to get your take on this, that having the supreme purpose of any business being the happiness of the people that work there is pretty unusual, isn't it?
Oh, it's really unusual. I mean, Richard Branson, with his Virgin Group, has always talked about, I put my people first because then they give great service. The American Constitution talks about life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. The King of Bhutan wishes happiness on all of his subjects, but not many people or not many places have that. So the reason I wrote Happy Economics was to explain to managers why it's important to have a happy workforce, but also how you measure it, how you achieve it. And I built a website called Workle, and a million people now have gone and taken our free Happy at Work test. And so we help people be happier in their jobs and to understand what really makes them happy.
Mm-hmm. So that's part of fixing things, isn't it? Working out what are the issues, what's making you feel unhappy. How important is money in this whole conversation and what people are being paid?
Well, it's not as important as you may think. I know people listening to your program will think, well, that's not right. But people want to be paid fairly, and they want to be paid fairly against people who do the same kind of job as them. So most people don't look at a professional sports person and say, oh, they're earning 100,000 euros a week, you know, I'm not paid that, it's not fair. What they do is they look at people who are nurses like them or working in a shop like them and say, what should I be earning? And the truth is that when people do that, what they think is, if I'm earning 10% more than I think I'm worth, then that's great. But it doesn't make them work any harder. But if they're paid 10% less than they think they're worth, it niggles away at them all the time. So pay is a hygiene factor. There are other things which are much bigger drivers of your happiness at work, like, are you recognised? Does your boss say, well done, when you do something well? You know, do they say, oh, you've done really, you know, great work over the last week, take an afternoon off? Those things, recognition drives performance more than pay. Mm-hmm. And there are a number of other things.
I just want to stop you there, because it sounds to me from what you're saying that you do have to have the pay thing right before the other things fall into place. Because if you feel you're not being paid what you're worth, you've said there that niggles away at you. So it's very hard then to get the appreciation right and to feel valued if the first box isn't ticked.
Well, that's right. You're absolutely right. You need to have pay so that people think it's fair. But you can have pay right, but if you're not being developed, if you're not informed about your job, if you're not empowered, if you don't feel the business is looking after you, your well-being, if you don't feel proud of what you do, there are all other reasons why you might not be happy, you might leave. So pay is one of the kind of six main things that drives happiness at work.
Okay, well, let's talk about some of the other things. And bearing in mind as well that there might be people who don't feel that they're in a position to raise these issues with their employer, because you mightn't be happy in your job, but you need it because you've got to pay the mortgage.
Well, that's true. And everybody's got a choice every day about what they decide to do. So for some people, they will say, oh, you know what, I get paid, I'm going to put up with it and for the pay. But there are people that decide they don't want to do that. I mean, we study industries and countries around the world. We've got data on 108,000 companies. We've got data on 6,000 Irish companies. Now, some people go into work because they're well paid. You typically find it in areas like finance. But then they don't particularly enjoy their job, but they put up with it. So you're right. Some people put up with the job because they're paid well. But for a lot of people, that's not enough. So what they'll decide is, OK, I might be paid enough or I'm not paid enough, but I'm going to make a choice to go and work elsewhere. And every day you've got that choice. When you wake up, you can either say to yourself, I'm not happy, I'm going to do something about it, I'm going to talk to my manager about what it is that's niggling me, or you can decide to put up with it. I mean, that's a positive thing to do. Or you can decide that you're not going to put up with it and you're going to move on. As long as you're doing one of those three things, then you're tackling that issue around pay.
Look, I'm happy as long as I get 10% more than the guy that presents that podcast on that site or wherever you get your podcasts. You know that one? That's where all the money is, apparently. Former Managing Director of Waitrose, former UK Trade Minister and author Mark Price there, talking to Claire Byrne this morning. Mark's book, Happy Economics, Why the Happiest Workplaces Are the Most Successful, is published by Kogan Page. On this afternoon's Liveline, Colm O'Mungoin, sitting in for Joe Duffy, spoke to Geraldine about an encounter with a drone.
I was down in Doolin on the side of the harbour opposite the two piers. And you have to go through, you have to walk through a wall, so to speak. There is a gap to get out actually on to the burn, onto the flat of the burn. And
you were on your own, were you?
The drone, well, I had my two dogs with me.
The two dogs, yeah. Go on, sorry.
Yeah. I could hear the drone, first of all, above me, flying very high. And then it went off, disappeared, and then it came back flying much lower. And I'm not mad about drones anyway. But the dogs and I were on the way back to the car, so I went back and through the wall and over and popped the dogs in the car and approached the two young men that I thought must be flying the drone because one of them had his head down and the other was looking up.
Right. And did when you heard the drone first, was it loud? How high up? Did you know it was a drone you were hearing?
Oh, yeah. And I could see it. It was very high and it sounded, it still sounded like a mosquito, a big mosquito. And as I say, it went off and then came back from the same direction, coming from behind me, from where the more wilderness of the Burren is, and flew over, but lower. Not dangerously low, but lower so that it was louder. And I could see clearly that it had kind of four legs and two things like water skis underneath and the size of it.
And could you give us, a rough estimation of how high you're talking about? As high as a two-story house, maybe higher than that again, as high as a flagpole? How high in the air was the drone?
Two-story house, probably.
Okay.
Second time it came. Yeah. Approximately. I'm not great at measuring things.
And so you saw that there were two men and one of them was hunched over. Did he have a visible remote control in his hand or were they basically the only people about? Is that why you assumed they were in charge of directing it?
Oh, the place was pretty empty, yeah. And they were the only people around. There were very few cars. And, because he was the pilot, if I can call him that, was...
No, that's the right word, yeah.
Me.
That's bang on. That's the right word, all right, yeah.
Okay. He was facing towards me, but obviously with his head down because he was looking at the little control panel, which was about the size of one of those. Do you remember Polaroid cameras?
I do. Yeah. For anyone too young to remember a Polaroid camera, they've made a comeback. They'd print out instant cameras. You'd be print out instant photos. I suppose you'd be looking at about the size a box about the size of two postcards, one on top of the other. Says he's using postcards, which nobody. But anyway, yeah. A small box, and there's sometimes a screen on them that shows you what the drone is flying over. So that's maybe why he was hunched over it.
Well, yes, yeah, there was. He was looking at the screen, and he was controlling it. So that would be the responsible thing to do, to look at what he was doing.
And was it annoying the dogs? Did the dogs make any reaction to it?
No, they hardly looked up at all, and they were in the car by the time I went over to talk to the two young men.
Right, and what did you want to say to them?
Well, I'm always curious about drone flying, so I said I'm curious. What is the enjoyment of flying drones? And the person who answered wasn't the pilot, it was his friend, and he explained that it was so that they could see places that otherwise they might not be able to see. And there's a little island out called Crab Island, and he pointed out to that and said, like there, for instance. So at that point I said, well, it's flown over me twice, and, I can do... Well, I didn't say to him, I can't walk on water, but I said, are you filming, actually? Is that what you do? Do you want to take away the film of the place? And at that point, the pilot said, yeah. And I said, I asked politely at this stage, would you please delete film of me with the dogs, because I like privacy, and to be honest, I don't like drones very much.
Right.
He then gave a little swear, and it wasn't anything very serious, but it was a word that I knew what it meant. It wasn't in English. And the first young man who'd spoken to me had spoken with sort of broken English as well. Good, but it wasn't his first language. So I said the word right back to him.
Right. We were not going to identify the country, but they were from a country that frequently holidays in the south and west of Ireland and have been well known for doing so for some decades. That's sufficient. And you recognised the language they were speaking.
That covers
it. And you've picked up a bit of it yourself. And so you repeated this word back to him.
It's a very common swear word. Yeah.
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 Manure, as a rough translation.
Exactly.
Yes.
Yeah.
So that escalated it a bit. You asked for your footage, the footage that had been taken to you, to be deleted. Insert foreign language word for manure here. Insert repeat of said word by you back to them. And where did it go from there?
Well, at that point, I think he was annoyed, the pilot was annoyed by me coming over. Anyway, because I just think he was. And at that point, he said another word, and I had no idea what it meant. I'm not that fluent, and I looked it up afterwards. But his tone of voice, you know how much you can tell from somebody's tone of voice. And his tone of voice was dismissive, abrupt, unpleasant, and angry. And he then, as he was turning away from me, and again very abruptly, said, well, you better get away now, because it's coming back if you don't want your face to be on it.
That's Geraldine telling Cullum O'Mungon on this afternoon's Liveline about her encounter in the Burren with some gruff tourists and the drone they were operating. Stand-up comedian Carl Spain joined Dermot Whelan, sitting in for Oliver Callan, in studio this morning to talk about his current stand-up tour, comedy in general, and the do's and don'ts of proposing to your longtime partner.
You write a lot for other comedians these days.
I have done in the past, yes. I still do, yeah.
Yeah. Is that different, the process of writing for somebody else? Do you hear them in your head?
Yeah, I'll come up with a joke and go, that's not going to, that works for a female comic, or that works for a gay comic or something else. The weirdest moment I ever had was a joke I wrote that I really liked and I wish I hadn't said out loud to the person I was working with. The first time I saw them do it on stage, got a round of applause, and I was standing at the back watching, a guy comes back, hits me a little too hard on the arm and goes, you couldn't write an effing joke like that. And I was like, what is the universe doing to me? And I was like, I could write one like it. The irony was not lost to me. But yeah,
is that good
thing,
though? Do you get a nice sense, even though someone else is using your joke and getting the round of applause or the standing ovation?
I get the kick from the laugh. Yeah. I've done it for fundraisers for people where you'll take people who aren't comedians and write with them. So you kind of get their story.
Mm.
And my favourite one of those was a priest who... I said, what's your funny story? And he goes, oh, well, my dog went missing. But everyone, when the news got out, everyone thought I had gone missing. And the bit I said to him, say that. And he goes, I can't say that. It's trust me. And he went on, he was on stage and I heard my housekeeper on the phone going, well, the last time I saw him, he was running around the garden. He just had his collar on him. And again, the room erupted. And he looked at me and thumbs up as in... You know, because it was such a surprise.
Yeah,
and it's not, you know, there's no way offensive. It was just a misunderstanding. But things like that where If someone has a body of text or an idea, you can see the jokes to put into it and work around it.
Yeah, because I know you've written for TV as well over the years, and I used to write for the Republic of Telly before I started presenting it. And if you got your joke used, it was a great buzz, you know.
Yeah.
You'd hear Neil Delamere saying, and you're like, oh, I wrote that. He left out the other 15 I wrote, but yeah. I wrote that.
No, I wrote for the news report, which Bernard for a bit. And everyone then afterwards, you know, the Viper, Ed Salmon, and then it was me. It just went, Al Porter. Then we can't find anyone. Will you just do it? But yeah, it's nice. No, I enjoy getting the laugh. Yeah, I go, that's my laugh. And it's a different kind of buzz. But
laughter doesn't always get you the girl, Carl. Or does it? Because people may remember your show, Carl Spain Wants a Woman, a few years back.
20.
Yeah, I can't believe it's
20
that long
years
ago.
But
that is actually how you met the lovely Rachel.
Yeah, she applied to be on the show. She also won a bike on television and... she doesn't get up on either anymore. That's a terrible joke. Yeah, we met on that. And that was actually when I started doing comedy, I thought, this is it now. Girls are going to be, you know, that's the one thing, you make them laugh.
Yeah.
And I think it was my second gig. This beautiful girl came up to me and she was saying how much she loved me. She was so funny. And I was like brand new. I, you know, didn't think I was that good. I actually probably wasn't. And she was looking away and I was just looking at her going, oh my God, look at her. And she goes, oh, my boyfriend loves you as well. And he'd obviously seen me looking at her. And I don't think he likes me anymore. It never really worked. You know, I could chat to a girl from the stage. Mm. But then when I came off, it was difficult.
But do you think a lot of comedians in general can be shy, nervous types, which is kind of a juxtaposition, isn't
it? Yeah, you'll read it from... There's that thing from lead singers of bands, the amount of them, like it's trying to impress their mother, like that have lost a parent or lost a mother, like Bono lost a mother, but loads of lead singers have lost parents along the way. I remember hearing Jimmy Carr in an interview talking about any comedian is just trying to amuse their mother. He had it with his, and I was literally listening to him. I was going, oh, that was me. My mum had been sick for a number of years and I'd be looking after her. And instead of dealing with her and going, what can I help you? I would become a character. I was Father Michael, who I was giving her gossip from the confession that I'd heard, making stuff up, like. And
yeah.
I was a doctor saying, oh no, God, if she was a horse now, we'd shoot her. To, you know, I was doing all this, but she'd start laughing. And that was, you know, making me feel better that she's feeling a bit better.
Yeah, so it's almost as if like there's a people-pleasing...
Totally that thing.
Reason behind it, that you feel responsible maybe. Because I think about this all the time and you think, why the hell do I put myself through it? You know, and I think there's often times, as you've touched on there, but there's a people-pleasing tendency. You feel responsible for how other people feel and you feel
it
like
that.
It's up to you to make a positive change.
Yeah, but I even, like at a gig... I don't mind a heckler myself. If someone's heckling, if it's a good or funny heckle, you know, I think it's good. But people who won't shut up and they're ruining the gig, not just for the comedian, but for everyone around, that really annoys me, especially when I'm not on stage. When I'm on stage, I can deal with it.
Mm.
But when I'm off stage, I'm going, you're like, this person's trying to make you laugh. You know, trying to make a room of people laugh and you're stopping it. That probably upsets me more than it should.
Yeah.
And it probably upsets other people.
Are you the type of person who, if you go to a party and the party's a bit flat, that you feel responsible to kind of get it going?
I would have been before I did comedy.
Mm.
I would have been... No one leaves that party not knowing I was there.
I think the word, cozy on the head, I think, and here I go.
Not quite that. But I know I would have been, not quite the life and soul, but yeah, I would have been, here's an audience, let's entertain. But once you have that facility where you can go on stage and be funny and people will listen to you, I think you don't, I'd suddenly that just disappeared out of my life.
Yeah,
I could sit with people and be normal.
Yeah.
And then if I was funny, so like five or six were sitting around, if I said something funny, oh, you're trying out material. And you're going, so it actually backfired in a way. So you wouldn't try and be funny in that
How many times have you proposed to Rachel?
She hates this. I haven't officially proposed, but I'd say five times. But let's
how do you unofficially propose?
No, we'd just say we should get married. She'd go, oh, you should go away and organize it. So
yeah, but hang on a sec. We should get married.
Yeah.
I mean, is the laziest, where were you, like down the frozen meat section of the supermarket when you said it? Like,
yeah, I've told you that story.
Looking at the sausages. did you ever do the proper proposal?
I haven't done the proper. No, that
no
would
wonder
be,
she keeps saying
that does, would be tough.
Does she say no or kind of fob you off?
We've kind of gone too much into my private life. I'm breaking down here, Oliver replacement. We kind of, like how she would put it, we both ruined each other for anyone else, so we're stuck with each other now. So, you know, at some point we'll probably make it official, but it wouldn't be a big deal, like, you know.
The sickeningly romantic Carl Spain there, talking to Dermot Whelan this morning. The Belfast hip-hop trio Kneecap are under investigation by counter-terrorism police in the UK for allegedly calling for the death of British MPs. This morning, the British Conservative Party leader Kemi Badenoch, apparently unaware of how the justice system is supposed to work in her country, demanded the prosecution of the band's members. On the wireless this morning, Claire Byrne spoke to David Hughes, political editor with the Press Association, and asked him to take her through the concert footage that the British police are examining.
The first incident they're looking at is November 2023, which is this allegation that a member of Kneecap said that the only good Tory is a dead Tory and suggested that people should kill their local MP. Kemi Badenoch, the Conservative Party leader, has come out this morning and said that they should be prosecuted for that. She's used fairly strident language about it. She said that, and I quote, Kneecap's glorification of terrorism and anti-British hatred has no place in our society. Mm-hmm. And then the other thing that the police are considering is a year later, November 2024, the alleged support for Hamas and Hezbollah, which are banned as terrorist organisations in the UK.
Now, as I mentioned, this is being investigated by the Met's Counter-Terrorism Internet Referral Unit. That unit is dedicated to identifying terrorist and extremist material online, David. I mean, this tells us that this is being taken very seriously. Is that right?
Yeah, it's been taken seriously. I mean, it, at the moment, it's being assessed rather than investigated. So they haven't launched a formal investigation, but they are reviewing the footage and they will then decide what steps to take next. And Kemi Badenoch has demanded that there should be prosecutions. And she can say that, but ultimately decisions on that are for the police and the Crime Prosecution Service to take independently. But clearly, yeah, she is wanting action taken. Because this is, it's only 2021 that... Sir David Amess, a Conservative MP, was indeed murdered. So there is obviously a very strong strength of feeling about this within the Conservative Party.
Kemi Badenoch, we should say, though, has history with Kneecap, hasn't she? Because she did block the government grant to them when she was business secretary, which led to a discrimination challenge, which they ultimately won.
Indeed, she's got form with them. I mean, she blocked that grant when she was business secretary on the basis that... she didn't want the money going towards a group who did not support the United Kingdom. And it should be clear that Kemi Badenoch's politics are very, very different to Kneecap's. So she's a unionist, she's a staunch supporter of Israel, and she is a conservative. Kneecap are none of those things.
Indeed, and they're not. The Press Association's political editor David Hughes there, talking to Claire Byrne this morning, about the Brits oppressing the Fenians. I mean... the UK security forces looking into possible breaches of terrorism legislation by the Belfast hip-hop trio Kneecap. There's a new theory, Ray Darcy tells us this afternoon, that the 5,500-year-old passage tomb at Newgrange was in fact a sophisticated observatory. Joe Fenwick, an archaeological field officer at the University of Galway, is the person who came up with that theory, and Ray spoke to him this afternoon.
Newgrange is perhaps the premier prehistoric megalithic tomb in the island of Ireland. It's famous the world around. It's a Neolithic passage tomb dating approximately to 3200 BC. And it's well known not only for the fact that it's aligned to the winter solstice sunrise, but the fact that it also has some remarkable megalithic art around its periphery and in the tomb itself. So it's quite a wonderful archaeological site, a very large passage tomb by any standards, and perhaps the most famous of its example
in the world, in the country, or in the world.
In the world, if it will, I suppose you passage tombs throughout Western Europe, essentially Britain and Ireland. But yes, if you want to say in the world, yes, certainly.
It was built in pagan times, so the people would have adored and been definitely in awe of the sun, because the sun was mysterious to them. They didn't understand it.
Yes, certainly. This is very definitely in pre-Christian times, 3,000 years before Christ was born. So you're speaking at a time when people, some people believe it's sun worship, but actually I believe it's really just a manifestation of a whole pantheon of deities that they may have had who controlled the movements of the earth and the moon and the sun. And they were measuring these things. They almost had a scientific understanding of the cosmos based on what we understand at this stage. Quite a remarkable understanding of the movement of the sun in particular.
Well, not to be glib about it, but they had no distractions, Joe. they could spend their life just looking at what happened in the sky, couldn't they? And there was no, obviously as well, we're talking about the sun now, but when it comes to stars and the moon and all that sort of thing, there was no light pollution. So everything was there.
No light pollution. You're absolutely right. They certainly had the time to observe and to admire the skies and the movement of the sun.
Okay.
Which is exactly what they seem to have done.
And the theory around why they built these things in particular?
Well, I mean, they're called tombs, passage tombs, so part of their function was obviously to bury people in the past, and the remains were cremated. People were cremated at this stage and placed in the tomb. So they're a cemetery, essentially. It's not just a tomb for an individual.
But why this intricate relationship with the sun, do you think?
These places were also cathedrals, you might say, and solar observatories. And all of these, their prehistoric religion at the time is probably part and parcel with their observations of the sun. So, I mean, there might be concepts of notions of afterlife and the rebirth and all the like with the sun shining into the tomb. But I think it was very much a part of their rituals and religion at the time. And a part of my search was actually looking into the ritual calendar of events that were occurring at Brunaboyne way back in distant prehistory. And this led to my sort of reassessment of some of the megalithic art in this area.
So this is a theory that you've discovered something that could be listed as a sophisticated solar observatory. So prior to your theory, what was this considered to be, this thing that you're going to talk about?
To be honest with you, I think people wouldn't disagree with the fact that Newgrange is a solar observatory. It is aligned to the winter solstice sunrise. So, I mean, it's not a contentious issue to say that it was observing the sun at this stage. What's interesting is the alignment is bookended between two vertical lines, one on the entrance stone, a vertical line on the entrance stone, and another vertical line at the back of the tomb on curbstone 52. And these essentially mark out the line that the tomb was set out on then. So they're kind of a baseline along a piece of string was strung along, you know. And that effectively marks the alignment to the winter solstice sunrise, but also, interestingly, the summer solstice sunset on the other side of the tomb. So Newgrange is actually aligned to two solar phenomena. Which is not that it's entirely new, but it can be proven, you might say, by the fact that these vertical lines occur on the two stones.
I suppose my question was, these lines have existed, and before your theory, they were just seen as two lines. Is that it?
The line at the front of the tombs was initially believed to be marking the entrance to the tomb. Now, I'm not the first person to notice the fact that there's a line sometimes at the back and front of tombs.
Yes.
And there's lines to the entrances of the tombs at Naoth as well. But I'm not the first to note the fact that these marked alignments.
So what's your discovery then?
Robin, so essentially the thing that was picked up, you might say, by the journalist or scientific journalist, Sean Duke, was a very small aspect of that. And it was really my interpretation of the art. And I noted that it was a bit of a peculiarity of the entrance stone to Newgrange. We know that Newgrange is aligned on the winter solstice. Mm. We know that the entrance stone was carved in situ. And of course, it stands to reason that the art may represent some sort of nod in the direction of the winter solstice. So the clue is the fact that what I always thought was peculiar was the fact that the spirals on the left-hand side of the vertical lines, they spiral clockwise inwards towards the centre of the spiral, while those on the right-hand side of the vertical line, they spiral outwards from the centre, and which is a peculiarity. And these were always considered to be solar symbols. But I can explain why a spiral is a solar symbol now in simple terms. Simply, it follows the way in which the sun moves across the sky during the course of the year. In the part of the year between the summer solstice and the winter solstice, effectively the sun spirals in a great spiral inwards towards a smaller, towards its centre. From the longer days in the year when the sun follows the dome of the sky.
As the earth tilts away from the sun.
Exactly, yes. So the spiral appears to get smaller as it moves into the centre.
Yeah.
Then comes the winter solstice when the sun appears to stand still.
Yeah.
And then it begins to spiral outwards then for the other half of the year.
As the northern hemisphere tilts towards the sun.
Exactly.
Yes.
Archaeological field officer at the University of Galway, Joe Fenwick, talking to Ray Darcy this afternoon about the celestial importance of Newgrange. Clinical child psychologist Dr. David Coleman was giving some parenting advice on Today with Claire Byrne this morning, and the topic of the right age to send a child to school came up.
I mean, some of it, I think, is to do with, you know, the, I don't know how you pronounce it, the Ecce year or Ecce year.
Whatever
it is.
We know what you mean.
ECCE.
The free couple of hours that you get.
Yeah, but because, you know, there's an age for kind of enrollment in that. And so that means then that sometimes children will have done 2 years in preschool and then, you know, but they might still only be kind of four. Or maybe four and a half.
That's
and
exactly
then...
what this person is facing. So the way it falls for our daughter, this parent says, she's due to start in September at the age of four and is turning five in December, will be out of ECCE by then.
Yeah.
And they're just really concerned that she's going to be too young to start at four. And then if they wait a year, she'll be 5 and 9 months. And is that too late?
No. Is the answer. That's not too late. I would still go for unless they find that their daughter is, like, you know, super kind of excited about moving on, really seems ready. So when you're thinking about primary school readiness, you're thinking about, are they academically ready? So do they seem like they're up for whatever little bits of learning will have happened in the preschool? Are they socially ready? So how are they getting on socially? Are they able to kind of, you know, kind of make friends, be with other children? What are they like kind of behaviorally as well? Some children just are flighty as you like and won't be able to sit in the bigger kind of structure, if you like, of a primary school, national school. And then you've got to look at their emotional readiness as well. And so sometimes children just aren't ready. And in my experience over the years, talking to so many different parents, almost inevitably, if you wait until they're five, even if they're 5 years, 9 months, even if they're 5 years, 11 months, they're still better off starting at that. If you look at some of the really successful educational countries, our countries that have really successful educational programs, typically all the Scandinavian countries, they typically start formal education age 6 or 7. So we rush it.
So your general advice is, if in doubt, leave it later.
Yeah, absolutely. If you can, unless there's a really good reason to start. And so, as I say, sometimes children are just kind of bursting to get out there, and you know that they're going to feel really held back if you do another year in preschool, that they're just going to be bored and then they're going to become disheartened maybe. But as a general rule, older is always more successful.
Yeah,
for
so
kids.
You've got to think about the other end of it. Like, you don't want your child leaving school, secondary school, at 17, possibly 16,
yeah,
if you push it too early, you know.
And then parents worry about their, I thought you were going to say the opposite, you know, what if your teenager is now 19 doing their leaving cert?
Doesn't but matter, does
I
it?
Don't think it makes a difference at all. And certainly I'm much more in favour if you have a choice. And again, sometimes parents don't have a choice simply because, you know, childcare arrangements, yeah, and so on, they just need it to happen. But if you have a choice, I would always err on the side of leaving till later.
Okay, let's move to this one. I have a 13-year-old boy, says this listener. From the age of 3, he has slowly crept into our bed. He has bad separation anxiety from me, his mum, because I worked a lot when he was small out of sheer necessity. The trouble is, as much as he wants to sleep on his own, he says he can't. Now, we really want our bedroom back. We know he wants to leave and go into his own room. Have you any advice on how to help encourage him?
That's 10 years of slow creeping into the bed.
Yeah,
that's a long time.
It's a long time, isn't it?
So I guess the thing, whenever you're trying to make a big change like that, where he's really in a habit, and obviously for him, you know, he carries a lot of anxiety, it sounds like, about being on his own. And yet, age 13, he's well able to cope on his own. And so the thing is to do some kind of a gradual transition rather than just saying, that's it, you're out, there's your room, you know, goodbye and good luck. What they need to do maybe is set up a little mattress on the floor in their own bedroom for maybe 2 to 3 weeks. If everybody's in agreement that this is a process that needs to happen, that would help as well. But assuming that it is, that he wants to go, they want him to go, set up a mattress on the floor in the room for a couple of weeks. Then have it that he's in his own room, but that you as a parent are going to sit in with him while he's falling asleep for, again, about a week and a half, until he's kind of used to being in his own bedroom, falling asleep with you there. And then the parent slowly, over time, again, just withdraws themselves. So instead of sitting in the room with him, you might just sit by the door, right by the door with the door open, and then you go outside, but you come back in for checking visits. And you do, initially, you're checking visits maybe every 3 to 5 minutes. And then as he gets used to that and accepts the fact that he can rely on you being there to come in and visit him and check on him, make sure he's okay, he starts to fall asleep without too much difficulty.
Well, it's exactly as you would do with the younger child.
Yeah, exactly as you do with the younger child. It's the same process for any child of any age who you want to move out of your bed. If you do it as a kind of a, like, that's it, we just can't cope, you've got to go, there'll be lots of stress for the child, but this is a relatively stress-free way that allows you just that transitional period. But you're looking at probably investing 2 to 3 months doing it this way. But then, you know, if that's going to have him settled and, you know, in his own room, and then you've got your own room back, you know, finally, sure, you'll be celebrating for months yourselves.
It'll be worth it.
Wow, well, that's one way to ensure you stay an only child, I guess. The parenting slot on this morning's Today with Claire Byrne with clinical child psychologist Dr. David Coleman. Finally, on this edition of Playback Daily, if you've seen the Oscar-nominated movie Sing Sing, you'll know what it's like to bring drama, of the theatrical kind, to a prison environment. This morning, Dermot Whelan, sitting in for Oliver Callan, spoke to artist and art teacher Daniel Sexton about teaching art in Cork Prison, and he asked him why he wanted to teach art in prison.
I studied in the Crawford, in the college there, studied painting, so I was always good with people and kind of more relaxed about things. So I studied interventions in education, how to intervene, you know, targeted audiences of people. So the prison was an obvious place. And so, like...
Is it an intimidating place to walk into?
No.
Not for you?
Not for me. Not for me, but I think the IPS do great service to the country because it's a fine balance, you know. It's a difficult question.
Yeah. There's a disconnect, though, isn't there, in terms of... We just have no real concept of what it's like. It's just one of those places you just can't know, I guess, until you've been in there.
And that's what's great about this today. You know, like, for the prison services to be trusting me to having this conversation, getting a little bit about the work we do in there. I work for the ETB in Cork, with my boss, Adele.
That's the
Cunningham.
Education Training Board.
Yeah. And they've been very supportive. So initiatives like this, like the Inside Out programme.
And what kind of insights do you get when you're sitting down with a group of prisoners? Do you know what they're in there for? Do you ever ask? Is it something that comes
up? It's up to choice. I can look into the phone, but I don't think I would do what I do if I did that. So, you know.
What's the room like where you teach art? Does it look like an art room?
It's a lot messier than this.
But does it look like... Because I remember in school, it was a room you wanted to be in because it just felt different.
Well, it's not grey.
Yeah.
You know, I've images and stuff up around the wall. Bits of painting. you know, letters from people, you know, on those kind of, it's a different type of environment. It's more of an environment that kind of gets rid of the grey of the colour of the walls for a while.
What kinds of things come up when prisoners engage with the art? Are they working through things through
the
art?
They can be,
what kind of stuff have you seen?
Well, like, it can be very self-reflective. You know, once you slow down, I think people have an innate ability to, you know, the idea of pareidolia, like the idea of looking at an object and seeing something in it. Like, we look at the moon, we see a man in the moon. So we're always trying to make connections visually, I think. So it's easier then to connect with people, I suppose, that way. And when you gain that connection with somebody, you can start them to kind of make and judge the art and talk about it. And slowly but surely, they might figure something else about themselves.
Would they have done art before?
Some of them have, some of them haven't. Yeah.
Would you think that it's a way for them maybe to get out of their heads a little bit? I would imagine that in prison you have an awful lot of time to think, mull things over, ruminate on things that maybe you weren't too happy about.
Yeah.
Or maybe your mind bounces from the past to the future quite a lot. Do you find it's a way for them to maybe to spend some time with their minds in a different way?
A little bit, but like, I don't believe in time travel. Like, you're here with me right now. We're having this discussion. We're here standing in this, sitting in this room. Like, you can't go into the future. You can't go back to the past. So I'm trying to make them be as present as possible. And like, you know, no phones, no time. You know, it's the other side of it I kind of come from, the more the engagement side of getting a group of students in there and opening their minds slowly. And that's why the Inside Out program works so well. You know, it's kind of a new initiative. They gain micro-credentials, so they're actually seen as UCC students.
And so do the students come in as part of their course?
Yeah.
And they spend time with the prisoners?
Yeah, in the classroom. They have a number of discussions. It was put together by a lady called Katrina Swarick, and she's a criminologist in UCC, the head of criminology there. So my part is, I'm just a small spoke in the bigger wheel of things up there, you know, so there's a lot more things going on up there.
What do you think people don't know or understand about people in prison?
How complex it is that they can find themselves there. You know, people are complicated in their thinking and their ways. So I suppose that's one of the main things I would look at, like trying to find the balance. Like, we are all artistic, but I just don't think people tap into it enough. I could pull it out of you now, if you want me to. So let's say, think of your favourite song, right? In your head, don't tell me, this is not a magic trick.
Okay.
So a lyric from that song, now pick a line from that lyric.
What? Oh gosh, now you're putting me on the spot. It's like...
But what is it? You can say it yourself, obviously.
I literally can't. I've gone blank. I've too many other things
you would,
happening
you would
in my
last
mind
in the classroom,
right now.
Dermot, you would last in the classroom.
Send a message to see the principal, or the governor in the case of the prison, I suppose. That's artist and teacher Daniel Sexton talking to Dermot Whelan this morning about teaching art in Cork Prison. And that's all I have for you on this sunny Monday edition of Playback Daily. The programme was compiled, written and edited by me, Neil O'Shurathon. Don't forget, you can listen back to all the programmes featured on Playback Daily on the RTE radio app. And the mothership, that's Playback, is on air and in podcast land every Saturday with a brighter, shinier, happier look back at an entire week in radio. But for me, until tomorrow, thank you for listening and good luck.